to Yesterday's Indianapolis, a podcast about the 200-plus-year history of the Circle City. My name is Ed Fujawa. I'm a local attorney and historian and publisher and writer of the Indianapolis history blog, class900indy.com. So today's topic is going, you know, I always talk about the 200-plus-year history of the Circle City, and today we are going back to the very beginning, to the start of that 200 plus years, to when Indianapolis, the site for Indianapolis, was actually selected. I've done some research on this topic already. In fact, there is a blog post I did back in, I think it was 2020 or maybe 2021. There will be a link in the show notes. But what kind of brought this up was by day I'm an attorney, and I was on a mediation, a Zoom mediation, with a mediator in Northern Indiana. And he had been reading some Indianapolis history, and he said to me, you know, paraphrasing here, of course, but he goes, Ed, you know, looking at Indianapolis, you know, there really wasn't anything there. You look around at other cities like Chicago, and there was something there that gave start to the city, but Indianapolis, there really wasn't, was there? And I told him, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you look around at some other cities in the Midwest, in Indiana, you know, Chicago, there was a fort there, Fort Chicago. There were also Native American villages right at the mouth of the Chicago River, which was a known and established kind of trade route. Fort Wayne, Indiana. Met Anthony Wayne, established the fort that was named after him there. There was also a significant Native American village near the site of that town. And it was also at the confluence of two rivers, which kind of gave rise to a gathering of people. Indianapolis, on the other hand, really didn't have anything here. I've written in the past about some of the Native American presence in Indianapolis when the city was founded, but there was no established town on the site of Indianapolis. There were some suggestion of small towns in northern Marion County, right along the Hamilton-Marion County line. There was also a reference to a possible town in southern Marion County, right near Johnson County. I did a whole blog post about that. I will link that in the show notes as well. But when we really look at where Indianapolis is, the downtown area right along the White River, there really was nothing there. And what we're going to explore today is kind of how Indianapolis came to be. So let's jump back. Today, this is 2025. Let's go back to 2020, 2021, when the city was celebrating its bicentennial of the founding of the city. Now, this two-year time period for this celebration is because it was kind of a phased founding. First on January 11th, 1820, the Indiana legislature, which was based in the first state capital at the time, Corydon, approved the appointment of a commission to locate and select the location for the permanent seat of government for the state of Indiana. Later in 1820, those commissioners, a group of seven or eight men, actually selected the site, and in 1821, the legislature, the Indiana General Assembly, ratified and approved that selection of the site as the future state capital of Indianapolis. So what I want to talk about today is focus on the efforts of those commissioners charged with selecting the site for the future capital during the spring of 1820. I'm also going to mention a little bit of what-ifs, because Indianapolis, the current site that we know today, was not the only site that was considered by these commissioners. So we'll play a little bit of alternate history. What if one of these other sites had been selected? How would Indianapolis have been different? As anyone who attended fourth grade in Indiana learned, the first state capital was Corydon in Harrison County. Indiana was admitted to the Union in 1816. Corydon had been the territorial capital since 1813. Prior to that, Vincennes, Indiana, one of the oldest continually occupied cities in the Midwest, it had been occupied by French fur traders, at least occupied by Euro-Americans, I should say. There were certainly Native Americans in the area. But Vincennes had been the territorial capital prior to that. And the reason for transferring to Corydon, one reason was that in 1813, War of 1812 was going on. There was a lot of conflict with the Native Americans. There was concern about the territorial capital being very much on the edge of the frontier and being subject to attack from Native Americans. There was also some suggestion that William Henry Harrison, the general and territorial governor of Indiana, whose political fortunes were certainly on the rise, his kind of seat of power was in Vincennes, and there was some suggestion I've seen in a few sources that transferring the territorial capital to Corydon was kind of perhaps a slight jab at him and to try to limit some of his power. Again, Indiana was admitted to the Union in 1816. At the time, the population of the state was centered in the southern part, the southern third of the state, right along the Ohio River and in the southeastern corner. And this was because the Ohio River was a conduit for transportation. So Indiana really would, you know, generally would settle. Euro-American settlement of Indiana was from the south to the north, with the Ohio River being the conduit to travel to various cities, Jeffersonville, Madison, places like that, eventually all the way down towards Evansville along the Ohio River, and then folks would move northward. So while the population was kind of congregated along the Ohio River, Native American removal policies utilized by the state and federal officials were ensure that lands to the north of Corydon would eventually be open for sale and settlement by those Euro-American settlers within the next few years of the state's admission to the Union. Part of Indiana becoming a state, the agreement with the federal government included a donation of a piece of land, specifically four sections, which we're talking about a survey, four sections of land, from the federal government to the state for use as a permanent seat of government. Now, the expedition to select the permanent seat of government really had its beginnings in the original 1816 Constitution, which decreed that Corydon would remain the capital until 1825. Even in the few years after Indiana became a state, there was an expectation that the future seat of government would likely be located along the banks of the West Branch of the White River. And the White River actually has two branches, the West and the East, although generally the West Branch is just referred to as a White River, not only in current sources, but a lot of historical sources just reference that as the White River. I think it's the more prominent of the two branches. So for moving on, we'll just refer to it as the White River. So this expectation was perhaps due to the river's central location flowing right through the middle of the state. And in late December 1818, Governor Jonathan Jennings wrote a rather heated letter to Joseph Meigas, the head of the General Land Office in Washington City, which was Washington, D.C., regarding a recent survey which, due to a mistake, would have allowed the bed of the White River to be sold to private individuals, thus hindering potential navigation on the river. The letter read as follows. I've been informed that the surveys in the 4th Range West and Township 9 North in Vincennes District have run across the West Branch of the White River, and thus the bed of the river will be sold to individuals and the navigation impeded. It must have been through ignorance or carelessness of the surveyor, as the stream is one of those which are declared to be highways. Purchasers will with great reluctance yield up that for which they may or have paid their money. I beg your early attention to this subject, as it is not unlikely that our permanent seat of government will be situated ere long on this stream. With great respect, sir, your obedient servant, Jonathan Jennings. So what Jennings is saying there, in 1818, they were already planning that likely the seat of government for the new state, which again, under the Constitution, was supposed to transfer from Corydon to this new seat sometime in 1825, they were already planning that it was going to be somewhere along the White River. Where exactly? Unsure. But it was going to be on the West Branch of the White River. So a year later, on December 7th, 1819, at the commencement of the fourth session of the Indiana General Assembly in Corydon, Governor Jennings announced his intent to move forward with the selection of a, quote, permanent, end quote, seat of government. Said Jennings, quote, the late extinguishment of Indian title to lands within our state and the progress of the United States surveys require that provisions should be made to select and locate site for the permanent seat of government, and the manner in which such a location shall be effected, as well as the number of persons to be employed in the election, should devolve on the General Assembly during the present session, end quote. The, quote, extinguishment, end quote, of the Native American title referenced by Jennings was the October 1818 Treaty of St. Mary's in Ohio, which resulted in massive land concessions by various indigenous groups in Indiana and which opened up a large portion of central Indiana to Euro-American settlement. And again, I mentioned that I do have a blog post exploring Native American presence around Indianapolis at the time of its founding. That goes into some, that talks about the Treaty of St. Mary's in some detail, so I will link that in the show notes. So with this charge from the governor, both the House of Representatives on January 1, 1820, and the Senate passed legislation, which was finalized on January 11, 1820, approving the formation of the commission to select the new seat of government. The commissioners chosen for this task represented several of the then existing counties or were prominent citizens of the relatively new state. Among their ranks was John Tipton, John Connor, and Joseph Bartholomew. Tipton was a elected official as well as a soldier. He had fought in the War of 1812. He had fought at the Battle of Tippecanoe and had served in the various conflicts against the Native Americans in and around Indiana and the Midwest. John Connor was the brother of William Connor of Connor's Prairie fame. Those two brothers had been living in Indiana for a long period of time. They had developed very, very close relations with the Lenape Native Americans, also called the Delaware, whose center of population was located along the White River from like the Marion-Hamilton County line all the way up to Anderson and into Muncie. In fact, Conner Prairie, which was William Conner's kind of trading post, there was an established, almost a Native American town at that site, and William Conner had also married the daughter of Chief Anderson, one of the more prominent leaders of the Lenape people prior to them leaving the state following the Treaty of St. Mary's in 1818. Joseph Bartholomew, who Bartholomew County was named after, was a soldier who had also served with Tipton, the Battle of Tippecanoe, and in various militias. So the records of the expedition of the commissioners are scarce, and the most detailed account of those proceedings actually comes from the journals of John Tipton. Tipton was a prolific journal writer, provides some very interesting insights and information about the early settlement of Indiana by Euro-Americans in like the territorial time and the years after 1816. Tipton had a kind of problematic history later, as he was in charge of the removal of the Potawatomi Native Americans in northern Indiana in the 1830s. So returning to the expedition, as recounted by Tipton, he set off from Corydon on May 17, 1820, to meet with the other commissioners to determine the location of the permanent site of government for Indiana. He was accompanied by Governor Jonathan Jennings, who was not a commissioner but was still basically tagging along with the expedition, and an African-American named Bill. Bill was often referred to as a servant in the footnotes in the index of the Tipton Journal, while Tipton referred to him as William or Bill, and sometimes as his, quote, boy, end quote. Bill's status is unclear, although Tipton's ledgers do indicate that Bill was receiving payment for his services and that Tipton had hired him on a yearly basis to assist during his travels. Bill accompanied Tipton and the other commissioners during their efforts to locate the seat of government. So Tipton's progress northward is detailed in his journal, including references to expenses and what the party had for their meals, including numerous mentions of coffee, spelled C-O-F-F-Y. On May 18th, he and his party were joined by Jesse Durham and Joseph Bartholomew, two other commissioners, and they continued together on their journey. On May 19th, the party stayed in Brownstown, and on the 20th, the party came to the upper rapids of what was described as, quote, the Drift, end quote, possibly the Driftwood River. On Monday, May 22nd, Tipton and his companions crossed Fall Creek in Marion County at a, quote, ripple, end quote, which is ripples often referred to. You see that in a lot of historic documents, basically a shallow, rocky area, maybe some rapids, an area where the waterway can be crossed. After they crossed Fall Creek, they then stopped to bathe and then proceeded on to William Conner's home, which was the designated meeting place for the commissioners. Most of the commissioners were already there, except two. The group was sworn to their responsibilities, and they adjourned for the evening. The next day, an additional commissioner arrived. The remaining commissioner never showed, leaving nine total. And the group set off for the mouth of Fall Creek to the south to assess that site. And when they say mouth of Fall Creek, that means where Fall Creek enters the White River, which was in what is today basically downtown Indianapolis. Today, the confluence between Fall Creek and the White River is near the VA hospital, right near 10th Street. On northwest of downtown, a little bit northwest of the IU Indianapolis campus. However, at the time, Fall Creek actually, its route cut right through the middle of the IU Indy campus, and its confluence with the White River was right near where the NCAA Museum and headquarters sits today. In the 1870s, the route of Fall Creek was modified, and the new confluence was developed. And I do have a blog post about that, of course, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. Once they arrived at Fall Creek, on the afternoon of May 23rd, Tipton and a few other commissioners then decided to head south to the bluffs of the White River, which was a landmark located about 15 miles south of Fall Creek. And this is actually right near where the intersection of, or the interchange of Interstate 69 and Highway 144. If you head west on 144 towards Mooresville, there's some high ground to your right, and that is what was called the Bluffs of the White River. Basically, it was a large hill that overlooked the White River. So as they were heading towards a bluff, they ran into some rather terrible weather with rain and wind. Tipton recounted that the lowlands next to the river were flooded, and their path took them through a swamp, which made travel more difficult. Tipton and his party stopped at 4:30 p.m. at a Native American camp between Fall Creek and the bluffs and stayed the night. The next morning, they continued south, along the way meeting a group of commissioners who had visited the bluffs the day before. So the bluff's location was reputed to be a site of an old French trapping post, but was also a known waypoint and meeting place for Native Americans in the area, as well as early Euro-American settlers. Tipton reported that the bluffs were 150 feet above the river, but uneven. He noted in his journal that the bluffs, quote, front on the river near 1 mile. If they were level on top, it would be the most beautiful site for a town that I have ever seen, end quote. In 1818, Jacob Wetzel, a Euro-American pioneer residing in Franklin County, Indiana, cut a trace from Laurel, Indiana to the bluffs with the help of his son and various axemen. This trace, later named the Wetzel Trace, would turn into one of the more important thoroughfares in what was called the New Purchase Territory. New Purchase was this land that included Indianapolis, central Indiana, that was obtained from the Native Americans at the Treaty of St. Mary's in 1818. The Wetzel Trace, there's actually some historical monuments down near Waverly, Indiana, which is right near the interchange of I-69 and 144, that really provided a avenue, or at least a roadway to for settlers coming into Morgan County, Marion County, and Johnson County, as well as providing access to the White River. Now, some sources note that Wetzel had the permission of Lenape Chief Anderson to cut the trace, although I was unable to confirm this claim. The exact dates that Wetzel and his company were cutting the trace are not clear beyond that the work was done in 1818, the same year that the Lenape and Chief Anderson were heavily involved in the talks surrounding the Treaty of St. Mary's in September and October of that year. And in my mind, the permission from Anderson may have been more of a legend and perhaps probably not received, especially considering the weakening position of the Native Americans in central Indiana at the time and whether they would have even have taken the time to travel far north up to the current site of Anderson, Indiana, which was named after Chief Anderson, to obtain his permission. But whatever the truth, Wetzel and his trace preceded the formal opening of the New Purchase to Euro-American settlement, and he and his family established themselves at the Bluffs, which became a significant way station for travelers, both Native Americans and Euro-Americans, who were jumping the gun on the opening of the territory. In later years, the Bluffs would be an important stop for travelers headed to the new seat of government from the South and would attract attention of land speculators, including Calvin Fletcher, who is the subject of an earlier podcast, and he purchased significant acreage in and around the Bluffs. Additionally, in the 1830s, the town of Far West, centered near the intersection of present-day Interstate 69 and Highway 144, was platted not far from the Bluffs. The town really never flourished, although Waverly, just to the south, was established in the late 1830s as construction for the Central Canal brought workers to the area. Now, one enigma of this area is the town of Port Royal, which was located at the bluffs themselves. Several sources note that this was the French name for the area, although it does not appear on any map I found until several years after the events of this blog post. Specifically, I found one reference in 1831. Tipton, in his journals, made no mention of the name Port Royal or any derivation of that name, although the treatise History of Johnson County notes that the town had a post office from 1824 to 1835, and the same source details the plat for the town, which was filed on May 18, 1822. Port Royal is also referenced frequently in the Indianapolis newspapers and Calvin Fletcher's diaries in the 1820s and 1830s, and sometimes the name the Bluffs and Port Royal seem to be used interchangeably. So the Bluffs themselves, I've actually explored that area by kayak. The White River is flowing south, and the Bluffs are a very, very large hill that overlooks the river and just kind of pops up out of nowhere. And if you go to the show notes, the blog post that this podcast is based off of does include some pictures of the Bluffs from a kayak trip a few years ago. And right at the base of the Bluffs, the river takes a very hard westerly bend and then doubles back again. It's a very, very tight turn, and the Bluffs really dominate that turn. And it's actually, the water gets very, very fast through there. I was kayaking upstream from a launch point farther south at a park in Waverly, and I had a very difficult time paddling upstream. Now, the current was quite strong, and then going around this bend, I had to actually get out on the inside of the bend, and I have a length of rope and drag my kayak. I was on the bank and then just pull my kayak along the shallow water because the current was just too strong for me to make any headway. Returning to the commissioner's activities, Tipton commented on the good supply of water in the bluffs area, including from a creek which ran along the bluffs and a number of springs which originated in the hills themselves. Tipton and his party crossed to the west side of the river to explore further and found the river bottoms flooded. He also noted at this point that the river took a hard western turn, which I had mentioned I experienced while kayaking, which he thought, quote, seemed to be very difficult pass for boats of burden, end quote. And basically what he's saying is they expected the White River to be used for commerce, to be navigable, to have boats carrying goods up and down the river. And he thought that that hard turn would be difficult for a boat to navigate successfully. Tipton also commented on the remains of several cabins, which he was told were the remains of a Native American camp and the French trading post from years earlier. Again, he makes no mention of Port Royal or any other name for the area aside from the bluffs. He and his party then headed back north and returned to Fall Creek on the 26th of May and found that Governor Jennings had returned to William Connor's home. So one of the things that I like to think about is, what if the bluffs had been selected as the site for the new city? I think the biggest idea that pops out of this is the topography. Not only were the bluffs, it's basically a very large hill, but the area around the bluffs is rolling. You know, nothing huge, no huge hills, no mountains, of course, but the area is very rolling, very hilly, very much in contrast to the current site for Indianapolis, which is extremely, extremely flat. So if you take a look at the companion blog post for this podcast, there's a LIDAR scan of the bluffs area. And LIDAR is basically radar, which is projected down on the ground and then gives you kind of a topographical map of what the ground looks like. And it's very, very detailed, and it's great for historical research. But it would have been fascinating to see how the city would have developed with this large hill being at the center of it, then the river cutting on the west side, and then these rolling hills all around. How the city would have, you know, would we still have had the Miles Square, or would the city have developed differently? So honestly, we could go on a whole podcast just talking about the what ifs of that, and I'd certainly be interested if anybody has any opinions down the line. But for now, we'll get back to the story of the commissioners. So on Sunday, May 27th, after their explorations of not only the bluff site, but also the site, the confluence of Fall Creek, the commissioners met and decided that the site of the seat of government would be located within Township 15 North, Range 3 East, which included the Fall Creek site. There's also some discussion that William Connor's trading post, the area around William Connor's home and trading post north of the city, north of current Indianapolis, was also considered as a site for the seat of government, although Tipton doesn't really go into detail on that. Tipton noted, though, that the townships had not yet been divided into sections, and Surveyor General Judge William P. Laughlin informed the commissioners that conducting the necessary surveys to finalize the location would take 10 days. The commissioners adjourned until the next Monday, and some, including John Connor, returned home while the remainder returned to William Connor's home. Tipton and some of the other commissioners then headed south along the White River, and after a brief stay with the Wetzels at the Bluffs, explored the territory south of that point, which included the area around Martinsville and down towards present-day Spencer, Indiana. Tipton does provide detailed descriptions of these travels south of Indianapolis along the White River, although I'm not going to go into detail because it really doesn't have anything to do with the seat of government. It was more about him just killing some time exploring the area. However, there's one thing I did want to mention is that Tipton did record details about the status and condition of the White River south of the confluence with Fall Creek, or south of present-day Indianapolis, and how he encountered a section of river which was just south of present-day Martinsville, where there was a series of islands in the river and the main channel was split several ways. He noted that, quote, "This obstruction entirely prevents the pass of any watercraft. Even the smallest canoe cannot pass them at this time," end quote. Again, this is going back to the desire for the White River to be navigable and to serve as a conduit for not only people, but also cargo. Tipton opined that the state legislature would need to act to clear this obstruction to allow navigation. So after their explorations south of present-day Indianapolis, Tipton even selected a piece of land that he intended to purchase himself, but he and his party returned to the Fall Creek on the evening of June 5th, where Governor Jennings and the other commissioners had gathered. The surveyors indicated their work had progressed enough to allow the commissioners to select the specific location of the seat of government. The next day was spent surveying and selecting the sections to set aside for the seat of government. Remember those four sections I mentioned before. And the evening, the commissioners crossed the river to the northwest of Fall Creek to camp for the night on a low bluff on that side of the river. And now, based on Tipton's journal, I think they probably camped somewhere around where the Michigan Street Bridge crosses the river today, or at least somewhere in that area. The next day, June 7, 1820, was the big day, and on Tipton's motion, the commissioners selected the site for the future seat of government. The clerk of their group prepared the paperwork for signature, and at 5 p.m., the commissioners met at John McCormick's cabin, which was located right by the confluence of the Fall Creek and the White River, which is in present-day White River State Park, and they signed their selection. If you go to the companion blog post for this podcast, there's several maps showing the original surveys that were done and how the seat of government was actually laid out. And you can kind of see the four sections with the White River cutting through the western side of the new seat of government. So in a piece of extraordinary coincidence, at 6:45 p.m., not long after the signing, the commissioners witnessed what Tipton described as, quote, the first boat landed that ever was seen at the seat of government, end quote. A small flatboat and canoe loaded with the possessions for two families who are relocating to the Fall Creek area landed not far from the McCormick cabin. Tipton explained that the travelers had sailed upriver in a keelboat as far as they could and then switched to the flatboat for the rest of the journey. While their arrival was serendipitous for the selection of that site and the belief that the river would be an avenue for commerce, the fact that the keelboat could not make the journey could have been considered a bad omen, although Tipton was silent on this point. No further information is known about the two families who arrived by boat, and the commissioners finalized their business and returned home. Tipton arrived back in Corydon on Sunday, June 11th, after an absence of 27 days. So going back to the possibility that William Connor's trading post was being considered as a site for the new seat of government, as I noted, Tipton's journals do not make any mention of this as being as that site as being under consideration. An editorial in the Indiana Quarterly Magazine of History, published in 1912, reported on a local rumor that the Strawtown area, which is north of Noblesville, was also in the running for the seat of government. The editorial notes that there was never a mention of this by the commissioners or Tipton in his journal and suggests that this possible location for the seat of government was more of a local legend. A final possible site was described by Judge Fabius Finch during a speech to the Tippecanoe Club in 1885. Judge Finch described his family, along with others, had moved to a site north of William Connor's on the western side of the White River near present-day Noblesville, in an area which was called Horseshoe Prairie, which might actually be the bend in the river by Connor's Prairie. Finch, who is about 10 years old at the time, recalls that the group were, quote, shown the beauties of our location, end quote, although it isn't clear if the visit was part of the commissioner's formal duties to select a site for the seat of government. Also, Tipton makes no mention of this visit, although some of the commissioners, including Tipton, went off and did their own thing at various times during their search for a seat of government, so there could have been a visit to that site. Legend also says that the Fall Creek location won out over the Bluffs by one vote, a story which is retold in several sources, including Barry Soulgrove's History of Indianapolis and Marion County, and Logan's History of Indianapolis. Usually the vote is reported at 3-2. However, I could not find any records to confirm this. Even Tipton's journal does not identify how the commissioners voted, although he does report that 9 commissioners had gathered at Connor's. Some of these same sources mention that Tipton was the deciding vote, although his journal is silent on this point too. Now, the commissioner's selection of the site of Indianapolis was just one step in the process for choosing a site for the new seat of government, as their selection had to be ratified by the General Assembly. On December 28, 1820, the commissioner's report and selection of the Fall Creek site was presented to the Senate. In that report, it's noted, quote, in discharging their duty to the state, the undersigned have endeavored to connect with an eligible site the advantages of a navigable stream and fertility of soil, while they have not been unmindful of the geographical situation of the various portions of the state to its political center as it regards both the present and future population of the state, as well as the present and future interest of its citizens. So what this was saying was that not only were they looking at the use of White River as a navigable stream for, again, commerce, things like that, but also they were looking at an area that was close to the political center of the anticipated future state of Indiana, especially with northward settlement, future treaties with the Native Americans where more territory would come into the state. They wanted something near the center of this future state. So the ratification of the commissioner's selection was done on January 6, 1821, and the actual plan for Indianapolis was laid out by Alexander Ralston later that year, with the sale of lots in the new town following in October. The reasons for selecting the Fall Creek site and even considering location along the White River was multifaceted, as has been mentioned previously. The commissioners were charged with locating a site near the geographic center of the state. Additionally, the prospect that the White River could be used for commercial traffic was a consideration, and the riverbanks along the Fall Creek site were lower than that at the Bluffs, which also gave the Fall Creek site an advantage over that location. The Fall Creek site was also more level in ground, and Tipton had actually noted in his journals that the ground around the Bluffs was rather uneven, especially on the top of the Bluffs themselves, which presumably would have made it difficult to plat out a city and construct a new city. So that is the story of the selection of Indianapolis as the seat of government. Again, you know, when it came to the city's bicentennial, we were really looking at two potential dates, 1820, 1821. 1820 when the commissioners selected the site, 1821 when that selection was actually ratified. Whichever one you want to use seems fine. I generally looked at it as being a whole year-long celebration of the selection of the site of Indianapolis. And again, if you want to theorize about what would have happened if the site had been at the Bluffs or perhaps even up at Connor Prairie, that's an interesting idea to consider, and I would certainly defer to, you know, urban planners or other historians who might have thoughts about how Alexander Ralston would have dealt with the terrain at those two sites. So thank you again for listening to this episode 7 of Yesterday's Indianapolis, and hope you'll listen in the future.